Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled A Conversation with Walter Wriston and Peter Huber, Part 2. Recorded in 2004, Walter B. Wriston, former chairman and CEO, Citicorp Citibank, and Peter Huber, senior fellow, Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, discuss the impact of the information revolution on sovereignty and power and explore issues related to privacy, security, and democracy in light of technological advancements. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
So where were you on October 4th, 1957?
I was in Baghdad, and that was the day that the news broke on the world that Sputnik had flown. And the reaction to Sputnik was mixed, to put it mildly. The President of the United States said that it really didn't make much difference. And other people thought it ushered in a new world. But it was the beginning of a modern age in many respects, I think. Even though Sputnik was, what was it, the size of a baseball or a volleyball, it was very small. But the fact that the Russians could do it was a wake-up call to everybody.
Yeah, in your landmark 1992 book, The Twilight of Sovereignty, I mean, you describe that incident and the varied reactions, and across the whole span, you had Teller at one end, right, the father of the hydrogen bomb, and Eisenhower himself speaking. How do you remember their different reactions?
It was an amazing event, and it started, I suppose it was a forerunner to geosynchronous satellites at the end of the day, which changed our world remarkably.
Stretching back perhaps 50, 60 years before that, you also describe in the book, it's a marvelous little anecdote. I don't know if you'll recall it, but the story of a fellow called Strauger, who was an undertaker in town with one competitor. Recall the story?
He was an undertaker in town, and his wife or his once close relative was a telephone operator. And in those days, you had a switchboard, and when somebody would call up that somebody died, she automatically referred the thing to her brother or whatever relation he was as the undertaker in town. So,
and Strauger himself was losing all this business, because I think it was the daughter of his competitor,
yeah,
who was, and he went on then to solve the problem, right, by developing the first
electromechanical switchboard,
telephone switch, to take the person out,
right,
and to basically take away their control of the flow of the telephone calls, right?
I don't recall how many people were employed as telephone operators, but it was an enormous number, which are now, as you well know, you please press 1, press 2, press 3. Yeah. If you live long enough, you'll get a real live operator, but there are practically none anymore.
Yeah, and I know Bell, around that time, had calculated that by 1935 or something, sort of every young woman in the world would have to be employed as a telephone. The insight you point out in your book, of course, is that, and it's a wonderful starting point for an anecdote, because you've got this little town and two competitors, and the guy who's got his sister who controls the telephone exchange has some real power in his little world. And of course, that's in your Sputnik chapter. Did you grasp at the time, or could you dimly foresee the importance of Sputnik? Because it's clearly played out, and there's much more than the satellite now, what Sputnik stood for had been enormously consequential.
Yeah, I think so. It's part of the dispersion of power. And it's the out-of-control society, so to speak, in which power is dispersed.
And governments were among the, or perhaps the biggest single losers,
yeah,
right? Hence the title of your book. Maybe.
I've had a kind of a interesting dialogue with my friend George Shultz on sovereignty, in the Twilight of Sovereignty. And we did back-to-back pieces in Washington, the Institute for Peace. And he arguing that the nation state was alive and well and the only one to deal with. And I don't argue the nation state is not there. It's still there. What I was arguing was that its power of unfetteredness has been attenuated by the information society. The flip side of that is that one of the problems with a war on terror is there's nobody to deal with. And so that there is no nation state. There is nobody that is responsible. And George makes that point, and he's exactly right. But on the flip side, when you have Jimmy Carter going down to Venezuela by invitation to tell a sovereign government whether or not their elections are honest, I would argue makes a big difference in the power of a sovereign state, which used to be absolute, and it's not anymore.
In your book, you trace out, I mean, maybe three or four or five strands in which these sort of central controllers have seen their power erode. And if I may, I'd like to discuss some of them with you, because it's a fascinating history. And of course, you were at the very center of one of those changes. But even before we get to the revolution in money and finance, I mean, the first implication that you trace out, governments lost control, as you put it, of, and you always put these things more gracefully than I could, but of their ability to frame and define what was true about their societies, right? Just the facts, the sort of reality of what was happening, and you trace out some of those examples.
Right? Yeah. Well, one of the things that happened after the book and all of that was that you had what amounted to a maverick journalist, a fellow called Drudge, who the mainstream media thought was some kind of a nut, posts on his website an allegation about the President of the United States and an intern. And it gets picked up by the main media, and it leads to the impeachment of the President of the United States. And I would argue that such a thing could not have happened prior to the information revolution, because there was just no way to communicate it. And so that erodes the power. And today you see it all the time with the blots all over the internet. And some of them are false, obviously, but some of them aren't. And they get picked up, and there's no way to control it. And the spin masters try, but if it's true, eventually it erodes the power of the central government, I think.
And we saw that, and you in particular, I mean, you were at the helm of one of these ships at the time, but I mean, we saw this, and you describe this in your book, I mean, as early as Vietnam, for me at least, who came of age during Vietnam, I mean, certainly the most vivid defining memories of that war are the television pictures.
Sure.
And one or two in particular, we can almost say this was the war, that picture on that television screen, right?
The war on television was, you know, the terrible carnage in the Battle of Gettysburg, for example. If we had had television then, I don't think it could have happened. I mean, these people marching up against lines of people are just incredible. But once the body bags keep coming back into Dover Air Force Base, and you have these images of people setting themselves on fire, have all of it, it was just horrendous. And it's burned into your memory and mine and everybody else's. What a horrible thing war is. And today we're just seeing a little bit of it with Iraq, in which public television every night has a silent recitation of who got killed last week. And of course, we kill more people in automobile accidents every year than we've killed in the entire war. But the concentration of that has a deep impact on all of us, and it should, but it's different.
And just tracing out that chronology, I mean, you mentioned, of course, in Vietnam, we saw some of the Buddhist monks immolating themselves. And then, of course, in 1988, there was another, you may recall, Jan Palach, the young student, burned himself to death as well. But I vividly remember, and you described this, or you mentioned this again in your book, I mean, as the tanks rolled into Prague, not 1968, the tanks were rolling in, and the Czech people who had no other resistance were chanting, as you described.
Yeah, the world sees you.
The world sees you. The world is watching. And
the world did.
It did, and the Soviets got away with it, so to speak, that time. But it was the beginning of what we saw 13 years later, right?
And you can argue whether it's good or bad, but it exists. It ties the hands of some people that maybe ought to be tied, and it impedes some people who probably shouldn't be impeded.
In 1988, and this is, one has to put this in context, this is when the Soviet Union is still the Soviet Union, after all. You wrote an article in Foreign Affairs, and I was struck by it as I was rereading it in preparation for this conversation, because you said a couple of things about the Soviet Union, which everybody can say afterward, but not everybody was saying in 1988. Maybe Ronald Reagan was as well, a few people. But I noticed you picked up two, well, perhaps you can remind me or I'll remind you of what, because you pointed to, this is several years before the fall, after all, and you pointed to two specific vulnerabilities that you saw in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, the ability of people to turn on the television set and see something other than the official propaganda undermined all kinds of sovereign governments. And today, the people talk about the concentration of the media, and it's true on some of the big ones. But on the other hand, the cable channels have so proliferated that there isn't any way that anybody can control it anymore, in my opinion. You see the Channel 2 and 4 and 7, their audience declines almost every year, and instead you're going to other channels that maybe from CNN to Fox News to what have you. But there's a wide diversity of the way people cover things that we didn't have before, in my opinion. And I think that's good.
But even sticking with 1988 just briefly, because you never want to admit to your own prescience, so, and I was really struck by it in historical context. You actually focused on two vulnerabilities of the KGB and the Soviet Union at that point in time. And one, you know, the humble VCR, right, and the videotapes that were then circulating, which by our today's standards is laughably primitive technology, but was already a destabilizing force then,
yeah,
right?
Very much so, because there was a huge black market in videotapes. Mm-hmm. And they went over the old spice routes, actually, that came in from the Middle East. And those videotapes circulated as black market in the Soviet Union, and people were able to see something that wasn't there. You know, it always struck me, Gandhi, Indira Gandhi, said one time that the most revolutionary thing that can happen in India is when an Indian of a lower caste sees a movie, American movie, and the wife opens the refrigerator door and the light comes on and there's food in there. And she said that's the first time that they have any idea that there's another way to live. that always struck me, her insight on that, which is true, because prior to videos, there wasn't any way for societies even to know how other people lived. And once they understand that the way they live, it may not be optimum, there are other ways, then you get this ferment that goes on, and it doesn't happen overnight. But I think it's almost impossible to sustain a dictatorship over time. We have a lot of them now in the Middle East, but on the other hand, you're beginning to see the pressure that's being brought on even the most dictatorial governments. They're just beginning to loosen the seams a little bit. And part of it has got to be the fact that the people are seeing the way other people live, and that there is running water, and there is air conditioning, and all of these things, so that the ability to project information has changed the world, I think, probably for the better.
And again, back then, you were pointing to the fax machine, which, of course, is an incredibly primitive web page, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
But as the new pamphleting era, right?
I remember, you remember Tiananmen Square and this kid in front of the tank. And it just shows you how much happenstance controls the world. It happened that the Russian prime minister was visiting that day, and therefore all the world media was there. We probably never have seen the tank if the prime minister hadn't been visiting. But instead of that, every television outlet in the world broadcast that thing.
No, and the Chinese couldn't stop it
coming
out.
And they couldn't stop. And one of the interesting things is the Chinese in Beijing had put in an automatic telephone exchange. Mm-hmm. And so there was a cottage industry grew up in America of expatriates who would put the latest real news on a piece of paper and send it by fax. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese couldn't stop it because it was an automatic exchange. And they all went out through these things.
It's our friend Strauger, isn't it, again? All the human operators had been...
They're all gone.
Yeah.
They were all gone.
So there was nobody there to close the gate, was there?
Right. And so the ability to get the news out is just extraordinary today.
You, toward the very end of your book, you're always a decade at least ahead of everybody, but you're quoting J.R. Tolkien, who... This was before they had all the movies, and his sentence, "The road goes ever on and on," and you say, and I'm quoting Walter Wriston now, "but this road, one travels at the speed of light down a million pulsing pathways, and the trolls are just not clever or quick enough to catch you." And that's much of the theme of your book, and that's just on the information, and there's
that's
more,
true.
Right? So
yeah.
the government's really lost what was, I mean, perhaps alongside their armies and a few other things, but I mean, there's a small handful of things that gave governments their power, and the control of information was very crucial.
The control of information was one of them. You know, the biggest draft riot in history took place right here on 49th Street and 3rd Avenue, in which hundreds of people were killed. And fortunately, the North won the Battle of Gettysburg, and Lincoln moved a brigade into New York. But nobody outside of New York City knew about the riots or how close we came to having anarchy here, because there was no way to amalgamate it. The telegraph had just come in, but it didn't cover the country the way we do now. And today, if you have 50 demonstrators for whatever, they're on the 7 o'clock news, and the camera is in tight, and you might think there are 10,000 people out there for all you know. And so you get this extraordinary wave of reaction across the country for sometimes very small groups. It's just almost the inverse of what happened in the old draft riots during the Civil War.
Now, the second big thing, as you describe it in your book, that governments were losing control of, not directly to Sputnik, but to what Sputnik represented, the communications revolution, of course, they were losing control of that second large thing to Walter Wriston, right? And to people like Walter Wriston, right? Their central bank, their money, their ability to have a Bretton Woods conference in 1944 and say, this shall be the value of my dollar and your franc and your mark.
Yeah.
And
they lost control of that when they went off the gold standard and went under the information standard. They lost control of that. And so it's like Kevin Kelly's book on Out of Control, in which he argues quite similarly to some of what I've written, that information disperses power and makes it more and more difficult to put out. Now we have an overload, I think, of data. I mean, you can find just about anything now on the internet. Or you take today's newspaper, you have people testifying about what happened before 9/11. Each one from their own perspective. And that, in effect, is quite new, because some bureaucrat can write a book that might die unseen 40 years ago. It's now on every newscast in the world. So you have they've lost control of what people say. Now, whether it's right or wrong is another issue. But if it's wrong, it won't last too long.
Well, let me ask you two concrete questions about money. If we roll back the clock to 1944, Bretton Woods, so you're not running the financial world yet, Walter. This is
never was, right?
Well, we've discussed that. But so Bretton Woods, a very small group of powerful people meet essentially to define the value of the most important stuff in the world, which is money itself, right?
Right.
And they seal that for some decades to come. How many people do you think it took in 1944 to set the value of currency itself? Was it a dozen, a few dozen? It was not a very large group.
It was a very small group of people, and they also amalgamated the myths that there were fixed exchange rates. And the reality was that it was a wonderful time for to be a trader, because the currencies could float up 2% or down 2%. So if you were a trader, you had an absolute limit to your losses, mm-hmm. and there was a limit to your profits, but there was a lot of room in between to trade. But the facts are that during the, quote, fixed exchange rates, there were literally hundreds of devaluations. And they do it in small increments, 4 or 5%. But it gave the impression, and most people called them fixed exchange rates, but they really weren't. And at the end of the day, they couldn't be sustained.
Well, if it was, I don't know, pick a number, if it was 50 people setting the value of the Western world's currencies in 1944, how many is it today?
A couple of billion.
It really is that many, isn't it? Every time I move something in and out of a mutual fund or buy a depository receipt or something, I'm influencing that.
Sure, you're influencing it. And every time you pick up the newspaper, people are looking at the paper and saying, what effect will, if that's your business, what effect will that have on the value of the currency?
to pick a concrete example, and this is in your book or us, one of your articles, I forget which, but within minutes after the Chernobyl accident, you described the market's response in some specific sectors.
Yeah, right? it just it's almost instantaneous, and as soon as it comes over the wire, well, you see it today. There's this, the Israelis go out and take out the leader of Hamas. The New York Stock Exchange goes down 140 points or whatever it was within minutes.
After Chernobyl, it was the agricultural companies, wasn't it? People had a vision of pollution and agricultural impacts.
The agricultural company, the stocks went down into the toilet instantly. And so,
but others outside of the Europe, but others were rising in response,
exactly.
Right? Because there was going. And I've read, I probably in something you wrote, most of the things are there that when Alan Greenspan speaks today, and how much influence he ought to have, one can discuss. But he, literally before he finishes a sentence, when he gets to some key adjective or verb, the one will see the markets moving. Right?
That's right. And there's a whole group of people who attempt to translate his hieroglyphics into something concrete. And he speaks in tongues, like all central bankers. And it's an art. And it's an art to try to figure out what he's saying. But once they do, the market moves.
But more and more, the market is there either simultaneously with him or even before, right?
There are people sitting on their cell phones listening to him.
It becomes anticipatory, which, of course, to the extent it begins anticipating him, it removes his power even more. Tell me, when you look at the euro, which is, after all, a rise of a significant new currency, does this contradict anything you said about currencies, or is it an affirmation? Is this a new affirmation of government power, or is it in fact a confession of defeat in some sense?
Yeah, I guess the real question about the euro is that, is it a transient phenomenon? And the problem with it is that they have taken away from sovereign governments the ability to run their own monetary policy, and they put it in Brussels. And secondly, the other agreement in Brussels is that countries can't run a budget deficit of more than 3% of the GNP. And if you're an 80-pound gorilla like France and Germany, you do run more, but you get a waiver. But my suspicion is that since these countries have different value systems, you have no mobility of labor, you have high social costs, that you will have countries within the euro market that will go into a recession more deeply than other countries, at which point I don't see how the euro can survive, because politics will say, I have to do something for my people. And you've taken away, I can't print money because it's in Brussels. And I can't run a budget deficit if you're a Keynesian and you think that works, because I'm restricted by this agreement. I could cut taxes, I could do some other things, but basically you've taken away the levers of monetary and fiscal power from the individual countries. And that's all very nice when there's a fair wind blowing. But when the wind blows badly, I suspect that some of the particularly smaller countries will have to opt out. But, you know, that's a fact, as your lawyers would say, not an evidence. But I suspect that over time we're going to see that play out.
I mean, the indisputable facts about the euro all seem to me entirely consistent with your thesis. In other words, you get governments surrendering control of individual governments, surrendering a great deal of control. Nobody can dispute that.
Enormous control.
And the question is, has some higher authority found a way to assert it, and I don't think that's the case. I see a net diminution of control. It's certainly an erosion of trade barriers as well. It's a surrender of, again, as you argue in your book, of ability to control trans-border flows and so on. So all perfectly consistent with a twilight of sovereignty, as you assert. And I don't see a concomitant rise of sovereign authority to offset that.
Yeah. I remember George Will, somebody said to him, what do you worry about now the Soviet Union is no longer? He said, Brussels.
Yeah, well, but it remains, yeah, if Brussels ever becomes anything.
Yeah, right? But it as I say, it remains to be seen. Yeah, and exactly. I suspect that the thing will fracture at some point.
Well, it will be interesting.
Because the euro was basically a political decision, not a monetary one.
Let me turn, if I may, to a third area that you explore in your book on the loss of the sovereign control. It actually, you didn't write this, but it brought to mind, and you pick up a more contemporary example. The story is told that when Oscar Wilde first traveled to the United States more than a century ago, and he probably made this up after the fact, but he apparently was asked at the border, does he have anything to declare? And he said his reply was nothing but my genius. And you have in your book, you make this the same point. I mean, if you cross the border with a diamond ring on, you declare the ring, but if you have $1 billion of software in your head, you've got nothing to declare, right?
That's right.
The mobility of your human capital. Not just the money, not just the Citicorp form of capital, but the stuff that's really worse, they can't control that anymore either, can they?
I was very lucky in college. I had a professor named Sigmund Neumann. He was the youngest professor ever given that title in the Reichsschule für Politik. And he came to our college, and he had not a penny in his pocket. And that's where I got the idea. All he had was his intellectual capital. He was the greatest teacher that I ever had. And he read a book every day of his life, and he wrote a book every year. And he tried to teach us about international thing. And he said, here I arrive in the country. I got thrown out because I was Jewish. And I came into a college. I've got the suit on my back, but I have in my head the ability to talk and teach and all of this. And that was the first time I think my light ever went on about the mobility of intellectual capital.
And of course, with so much more of our wealth now lodged in these extremely portable assets, if it's not in your head, it could be on a CD-ROM or something, right?
Bill Gates can walk across the border with nothing to declare, but he has the ability in his head to create something that is totally different. So.
Yeah, so with more and more of the wealth in this, basically either in bits or in mental bits, the sovereign's power to nail that down. You explore the deep history of this. When it was all in land, the value couldn't walk.
Yeah, the basic revolution, in my opinion, is when what is perceived as creating wealth changes. And as you know, originally, when men were nomads, their wealth was how many head of cattle they had, and nobody cared about land because you just moved the cattle on. And when the plow was invented and the domestication of animals to pull the plow, suddenly agriculture took off, and nobody cared how many head of cattle you had, they cared how much land you had. And so land was the wealth. And that went on for a long time until the steam engine, which started to pump out old mines, was harnessed for glooms and so forth. And suddenly you had the Industrial Revolution. Land was still popular, but the wealth was made by industry. And so every time this turns over, the people who had a vested interest in the last way to make wealth are very unhappy, and they make a lot of noise and so forth. And right now, the way to create wealth is through intellectual capital and not through industrialization. And so you have a lot of very unhappy people who were wedded to the industrial side. You have to make things, you have to make widgets that you can see and touch and feel. And yet the wealth is being created by people who are doing things you can't even see, like biotechnology, or writing code to run a great machine and so forth. So that we're now in the transition period from the industrial society into one of intellectual capital. And all those revolutions cause massive distortions in society. And that's part of the trauma, I think, that's going on in the world today. Because the guy who put the wheel on the Cadillac is no longer the head of the labor situation. Rather, it's some kid dropped out of school writing software somewhere. And the people who did honest labor, in quotes, so to speak, resent that. And the people that made a lot of money in the industrial society are scornful in the beginning about people who made a lot of money in intellectual capital.
And the government's ability to control this movement or tax it or to shape its direction is declining
every day. It's declining all the time, right.
Let's turn to the flip side, and you already anticipated me a few minutes ago, but is not today's evidence of the decline of sovereignty, the dreadful evidence of that, Osama bin Laden? Isn't he the stateless sovereign, the global force who can change elections and shape our foreign policy and so on, but nobody can call his Secretary of State? You can't even find him. Is that a consequence?
That's the downside of the twilight of sovereignty. And that's why very thoughtful people like George Shultz say that the nation state is the only thing that you can deal with. And that's one of the problems with the Middle East, with the Palestine and Israel, that Palestine is not yet a nation state. So who do you talk to? Well, you talk to people who say they're the leaders. Well, what can the leaders do? Well, they got no parliament, they got no law, they have no courts, they can't be responsible.
But even if they did, supposing there were the Palestinian state, there is a Saudi state after all, it's a very sovereign state. I mean, it wields a huge amount of authority, and yet it is a child of the Saudi state,
yeah.
Osama bin Laden, who has used, of course, exactly the tools that you describe. I mean, he used his cell phone and his satellite phones. Now we learn to track some of those, but his press releases go out over the satellite television and perpetuate his influence, promote it, and he sends his tapes to the broadcast media, and he apparently finds ways to communicate over the web and so on. So the people we don't like have learned to enlist up to a point tools too.
The technology is amoral. It's open to all. And the smart people like bin Laden and the others are using it to thwart what we're trying to do. And, we have a aerial over Australia, the size of a football field, that picks up all the cell phone conversations in the Middle East. And so we read everything out there, and the New York Times thoughtfully put that on the front page one day. So Saddam Hussein buried all his cables down below the ground. But the technology on the satellite is based on keywords. And so of all the thousands or tens of thousands of conversations that feed into the satellite, that the satellite does not relay them to us unless these keywords are hit. And if they're, I don't know what the keywords are, but if it is, then it funds into NSA. But then those are hundreds of messages. So at the end of the day, somebody with intellectual horsepower has to sit down and figure out, do I tell the President of the United States about this, or do I tell my boss, or do I throw it in a wastebasket? And that's where the disconnect between the data and policy comes out. Somebody has to make an interpretation.
And of course, we clearly have lost some battles to these forces of anarchy that are taking advantage of these same technologies.
Sure.
And we fight back as well, and you anticipate this again in your 1992 book, but you discuss smart weapons generally, and I notice in 1992 you defined, or you pointed to one definition of the smart weapon as a weapon that could receive information after it had been launched. Or now, 12 years later now, those weapons are commonplace, and in fact we have the full two-way dialogue with these weapons, don't we?
Yes, and we have weapons that go out and look around for something, like the Predator.
And they show us what they see.
They show us what they see, and they have automatic readings of global positioning system, and so that you can put a cruise missile literally down a chimney.
And fly it around for an hour before it goes anywhere.
Yes, it's amazing.
I mean, there's a book that Carlo Cipolla, the great economic historian, describes what he views as the two key technologies between 1400 and 1700 that changed the face of the world. And he sees them as the cannon and the sailing ship, both of which were, of course, instruments for projecting power. And it seems to me and I'd be very interested how you react, but one sees the very positive effects of these technologies that you describe in your book, you know, the fall of the totalitarian regimes. One then sees the rise of a man like bin Laden and comparable people, which is quite terrifying as a replacement to Uncle Joe and these people. But then, of course, we develop new countermeasures against them, right? Decentralized weapons and intelligence. Do you remain an optimist overall about the overall balance?
Oh yeah, I remain an optimist because any new device that comes out can be used for bad people, but it can also be used for good people. And when you consider the extraordinary increase in the quality of life and the living that has happened in a country like the United States, it's just extraordinary. And so, yeah, there's always a downside, but basically there's a tremendous upside. And just as Bin Laden is able to use anthrax or some other horrible thing, it's also true that the biotech industry, in my opinion, in the next 10 years is going to change the world of medicine in most extraordinary way.
Now, Bin Laden's attack on New York in 2001, of course, used our technologies, I mean, our planes particularly, which is one of the largest kind of civilian masses of power one can hijack and turn against people. And of course, a very central part of our response has been to secure the transportation system as a result. I'd be interested in your reactions, because as I see, and this has been very controversial, as you well know, the technologies that Walter Wriston personally was so instrumental in bringing to the mass market, and I think specifically of what are now commonplace things like my credit card and the electronic booking and payment systems that are behind that. I mean, those are now at the central databases and networks that are in fact being enlisted to re-secure our transportation system. I mean, I and you, you know, we book through travel agents, we arrive in the airport, and it's become quite effortless, actually, to get through. They know us immediately, and it's heartening.
But, you know, the guy that invented dynamite thought that he had prevented all future wars because nobody would use anything that bad. And it turns out that dynamite turned out to be used in all kinds of wars and terribles. So that I remain an optimist because there are more good guys out there than there are bad guys, which is where you start. And therefore, their use of the technology will be twice as great. But it's somewhat similar to encryption. It used to be said that whatever you could design as an encryption system could be broken by somebody else. And maybe that was true in the past. But with computers today, you can write so many random numbers on one-time pads and so forth that you wonder whether that's true anymore. And if it isn't true, the good guys just won one. But you can also say, well, on RSA and the other public encryptions, that's being used by the terrorists too. So,
well, people have traditionally said, I mean, people who fear networks and big government and so on have traditionally said that the instruments of Citicorp, my credit card histories, all of which are in the massive databases that you and your colleagues pioneered, that these would become very powerful instruments for invading my privacy and exposing my soul. And I mean, that risk, I'm sure, is ever present. On the other hand, they've delivered also a huge amount of offsetting anonymity, haven't they? The ability to shop at a distance or to just take your ATMs, which you pioneered, the bank teller machines. One can instantly anonymize one's transactions by moving into the cash world at a yard from the point of sale, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, everything is a double-edged sword. And right now, one of the issues is that there is a company in the United States that does integration of all these databases. And one of the moral questions right now is, does the United States of America access that thing in order to build a profile of terrorists? And the privacy people say, this is the worst thing that ever happened. Why should they know that I rented a pornographic movie or something? And the government says, yeah, but if we can build a profile of what a terrorist looks like and how he operates and works, you'll get through the airport twice as fast because we'll have that out there. So I think we have this tension between the right of privacy, which is very important to anybody. Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, the greatest freedom in the world is the right to be let alone. And we're not being let alone very much anymore. And that's probably the downside of the information revolution.
Yes, although I think you state it with a sort of typical balance and modesty. In my life, at least, I think Walter Wriston has given me much more privacy than he ever took away from me. You know, we've been discussing security and privacy. By and large, it seems to me the exit we're arriving at is to make it an opt-in system. I want to travel quickly through airports. I, as it happens, have rather little to hide in my boring life by choosing to use the credit card and the travel agency and these networks, I become easily cleared through. I don't have to, and the government will still let me travel. It will just screen me much more carefully at all these gateways. I don't, and it becomes really my choice.
Yeah. Well, every time I go up the country, I cross the Triborough Bridge, and the Easy Pass records the fact that I left Manhattan. Does that bother me? No. But from the terrorist point of view, catching terrorists, very helpful to the government. Should they have access to that database? I really don't care whether or not they know whether I left.
And if you don't want to be in that database, you can still toss the quarters,
You can toss them, yeah.
Or the bills, whatever it may be.
$3 and a half these days.
Yeah,
but exactly, so that, well, it's a dilemma, but it's the balance is on our good guy's side, I think.
At the very end of your book, and you just quoted Oliver Wendell Holmes, you actually have a second quote of his at the very end of your book where he said, "The best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market. Yeah. And you, with characteristic diffidence, if I may be so bold, you end your own book very cautiously, but on, I think, a slight note of optimism. You then quote Lincoln, who asks, you know, on the subject of freedom generally.
Is there a better or an even equal hope in the world?
Hope in the world. You've read your book, too,
I see. Yeah. Right. Yeah, well, I believe that very strongly. And during my lifetime, I've had the rare opportunity to travel around the world on somebody else's nickel, so to speak, and do I don't know how many countries. And I've seen just about, I was in Nazi Germany very briefly when Hitler was there. I was in when Mussolini was there. I was in Chile with Pinochet. I was in Russia, Gorbachev. And the horror of centralized government and Big Brother made an indelible impression on me. And with all of the problems of a democracy, and there are a lot of them, sounds ridiculous to say I agree with Lincoln, because he was such an extraordinary man, but I believe that the best hope for the world is to spread the information and to have a democratic society in some way, and I believe the information revolution is on the side of doing that. And the argument can be buttressed by the fact that 25 years ago, I'd go down to Latin America, and there wasn't a single country there that wasn't run by a Perón or something. And today, the vast majority of them have some form of democratic society. Now, it's not our model, and it's not pure, but neither is ours. But I would argue that a great deal of that liberalization came out, which Indira Gandhi said, somebody opened the door of the refrigerator, and they saw there was another way to live. And so that's why I'm an optimist, because the more countries that become democratic or start down that path, I think the better chance the world has to settle down a little bit from the horror of the wars. And see, I lived through World War I and World War II and Vietnam and Korea. It makes an impression on you. There's a generation growing up now that hasn't got a clue what a war is like. The best news that we had was the bravery of Rumsfeld in putting what he called embedded journalists with the troops, which, of course, they had in the Civil War. And the anchor people would sit there and say, hey, we're losing the war, our lines are too strong, And the embedded journalists would come on and say, hey, we're at the gates of Baghdad, and we're winning the war. And I thought that was a brilliant thing. It must have been a riverboat gamble, and it won. And so I think that the more information that gets out, the better and the more freedom we'll have in the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been an honor and a privilege to
have a chance. I don't know whether it did any good to talk with you. There we go.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.